Welcome to the Professional Engineer Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the 14 grand challenges for engineering in the 21st century that was published by the National Academy of Engineers. So these 14 grand challenges focuses around four general themes, which is health, security, sustainability, and the joy of living. So first we're going to jump into the three that are categorized under health. I'm going to list the three of them, and then we can kind of run through my view of each. But the first is to engineer or engineering better medicines. And then we have advanced health informatics. Then finally, reverse engineer the brain. So I want to start hitting on that advancing health informatics, because that one is what jumps towards me the most. Because it's something I thought about a lot, actually. And it's the amount of data that we can generate from our devices that we currently have that everyone is really gathering, some of them more than others, and then how we could take that data and do something with it. For example, if you have a Fitbit or a Google Watch, Apple Watch, anything like that, it's all tracking your heart rate. It's tracking your number of steps. And I saw with the Google or with the Apple Watch that they were able to even detect changes to your rhythm of your heart that could potentially be indicative of a stroke. And that's fascinating. Just something that's a wearable, not even something that is under your skin or in touch with your blood, just what they can get from really whatever sort of sensors they have installed, whether it be accelerometers or something with infrared that is reading or ultraviolet, whatever, that is reading your pulse. They're able to determine something like that. And really at the infancy stage of this, you know, I have a smart scale that I step on every day just to get that data point, you know, where I am relative to yesterday, you know, how, you know, plus or minus 5 pounds throughout the day, depending on how much water I drink and how much I eat. Then I wake up the next morning and it drops 5 pounds. You know, all these data points that we have that we generally keep into ourselves. What if we were to start to aggregate those together? And then what if we were to start to tie that to blood work that we have taken? You know, like, but then what if we start aggregating that information together? And then what if, you know, and this is where I think there's actually a commercial application for this. And it has to do with diabetics, right? You know, I don't know too much about diabetes. All I know is that, at least in the United States, that insulin is a very hot topic issue. You know, people need insulin to survive, to manage their diabetes. And the prices are kind of very difficult to manage. And other countries have done it better, but that's a different topic. Because I think the United States is and must remain as the leading country that pushes health and health management and health treatments. They need to be on the cutting edge of developing new things in that realm. But going back to the potential business option here is, with, say you put all the diabetics, you know, millions of people, millions of Americans probably, and then, you know, around the world, probably 100 million people or something like that, at least, are diabetic. And what if you take all of their data, and HIPAA laws, by the way, we'll touch on that in a little bit, but we take all their data and we aggregate it together, and we take as much information as we can learn from them, and it anonymously. It doesn't need to have a name tied to it, but it should, because through layers of security, obviously. But we take all this data and start aggregate together and see what we can learn from it to develop new treatments, which leads us into engineering better medicines. You know, that is how we can begin to tailor medical treatments and healthcare to an individual's genetic information, and to provide healthcare that is specifically designed for the individual. I think it's inevitable, right? You know, right now our healthcare is very broad brush, but perhaps people who have specific DNA strings or specific lines of code in their genome respond better to certain treatments or worse to certain treatments. And how do we begin to tailor that? You know, right now we do clinical trials on small scales, 100 people, 10 people, 1,000 people, you know, like a 4,000 person clinical trial is a huge trial. But what happens if we start to open that up to the masses? And in order to do that, like, I think we need to provide financial incentives for people to open up their HIPAA restrictions. Their HIPAA is extremely important for a reason, but what happens if a person wants to anonymously use their data for advancement and they sign away some of their HIPAA rights to do so? Then what happens if that same company pays you to get blood work every month, pays you to step on the scale every day, record your weight, record your number of steps, record your heart rate throughout the day? And then even taking it beyond that, what happens, and this is where you get into some of the conspiracy theories, but what happens if that company decides, you know what, I'm going to pay you to put this injectable under your skin, and this injectable we've engineered and designed to track this whole litany of other things that you cannot get from a surface wearable, but from an injectable you can get an incredible amount of data and monitoring, and then we start to aggregate these billions and billions of data points and do something with it. And that is something I really look forward to exploring more of, people who are actually familiar with healthcare and the sort, to understand, is this viable? Where is the field currently in this? And yeah, which leads me to the third of the 14 grand challenges related to health, and that is to reverse engineer the brain, which, okay, that is totally science fiction. This one really just boggles my mind. But, you know, we have AI and computers that are starting to scratch the surface of emulating human intelligence. You know, imagine if these were designed through reverse engineering of the brain instead of, you know, from scratch. And, you know, my mind instantly goes to like Neuralink and what they're doing, trying to put a computer chip or something into your brain that you can use to control processes. And apparently they've made some incredible strides in that. It's not something personally I would consent to. I'm not interested in being the, lack of word, a guinea pig on the subject, but there are other people, and really that's what they're first tailored to, is helping people who have degenerative neural diseases regain functionality. And they are prime candidates to do that. This is not, at least right now, maybe 100 years in the future, it'll be done recreationally or for performance enhancement. But right now it's done to, or hopefully will be done to mitigate diseases and neural degenerative disorders. So moving on to the next topic of the 14 grand challenges of engineering, we have security, which is lumped into three broad topics. The first being securing cyberspace, the second being preventing nuclear terror, then the third, restoring and improving urban infrastructure. So if you listen to the introduction episode, you'll notice that I am a civil engineer. And so the restoring and improving urban infrastructure is something I work in every single day. And that's certainly the one I know the most of. But for this episode here, we're not going to dig too far into that. There will be plenty of those in the future. But, you know, transportation infrastructure, along with water, wastewater, energy, you know, every fundamental system that holds our cities together is really aging. You know, most of the stuff being built around the turn of the 20th century, and then the Eisenhower Interstate System, you know, that all those installations have a finite life associated with them, and they need to be modernized. They need to be rebuilt to renew their service life. You know, getting 75 years, 100 years, 125 years out of this stuff is where a lot of it is right now. And the bottom line is it needs to be rebuilt, and then rebuilt in such a way that we're preparing for how to solve a future generation's problem of having to eventually replace that, you know, sometime in the 22nd century or the 23rd century, whatever. Some pretty far-fetched thinking. But I design roads and bridges, which are increasingly challenging to replace when 100,000 cars drive across certain bridges a day. It's an incredible volume that needs to be mitigated while you completely rebuild that infrastructure with having as minimal impact to the surrounding areas as possible. And that's only going to become further challenging as more people move to dense cities where these projects are happening. And also trying to design a better transportation system. Just because we have the one in place right now, there can be improvements made to it, and some minor, some drastic, like trying to accommodate, you know, rail, light rail, improve bus systems, that whole slate. A whole lot to talk about this subject, and we'll save securing cyberspace. This one is, I think it's obvious to everybody, since the advent of computers and the advent of the internet, etc., there's always been a imperative need to secure cyberspace. And it's only going to become further demanding. And that's why actually this type of position, like information specialist, IT, whatever you want to call it, the computer security system is an extremely fast growing profession in the United States and around the world. And you need to secure cyberspace from both state actors as well as from malicious actors. And I think no matter what, you're going to have this. This problem will never go away. If the only thing is to get more and more sophisticated and need better systems to mitigate that. And in fact, I think, you know, where I live in Florida, Tampa specifically, I saw an article where a water treatment facility was compromised to the point where the person who infiltrated the system would have been able to adjust the concentrations of chlorine or chemicals or oxygenation processes going on into the water supply that was then being distributed. So they could have 10x or 100x the amount of a certain chemical being introduced in really, you know, micro quantities into the water. Chlorine is used, I believe, and they could have, you know, drastically increased the quantity of how much would be introduced, which I would expect would have had some significant unforeseen effects. Thankfully, they identified the issue before it occurred, before anything was compromised. But, you know, this is a problem that needs to be mitigated. And I look forward to exploring where we are going with that. So, leads us to the last topic within security, which is about preventing nuclear terror. You know, I don't know too much about this subject, and actually building quickly upon the cybersecurity component, I do know that the United States system is built upon floppy drives and stuff predating floppy drives, which actually is just an inherent security component to itself because it's not really connected to the internet in any sort of way. But I expect that to eventually be modernized, particularly because the technology is just so old. But how you do that is a whole different discussion. But I'm not so much interested in hearing about maybe I should be interested in hearing about that, but talking specifically, the way the National Academy of Engineers outlines preventing nuclear terror is that, you know, technologies and methods to prevent a nuclear attack or the response to a nuclear attack or accident needs to be advanced. Now, I don't know too much about this subject, so I'm going to keep it at there, but we will learn. We will dive into that one. So that wraps up security. Jumping to sustainability now, there's actually, I guess, five topics within this one, which is making solar energy economical, providing energy from fusion, developing carbon sequestration methods, managing the nitrogen cycle, and then providing access to clean water. So actually in the introduction, I hit on making solar energy economical a little bit. You know, it's going to happen. And I think dialing down to just solar energy may not be appropriate. Really, it's making sustainable energy economical. And I think a good framework to work with that I have not yet verified, but I want to, and it's actually not that hard of a thing to verify, but there's a quote from Elon Musk floating around that if you have 100-mile by 100-mile installation of solar panels, that would provide enough energy for the United States to meet all of our energy needs. Now, there's many criticisms you can apply to that, like what happens if the sun doesn't shine? And that's where battery storage and storage of energy comes into play. And we're going to explore that and possibly see if we could implement something like that. What sort of dollars would be required to do that? And is that dollar figure going up or down as we get into the future? Because eventually you're going to hit a point where, at least in my opinion, where you've kind of plateaued on that whole S curve or whatever. You've plateaued of the energy cost or the cost savings advancements associated with solar. You still need to pay people to maintain them. You still need to pay people to manufacture them. And you need to reward those manufacturers and those employees of those manufacturers through not only living wages, but competitive wages. So eventually there's a point of, and by the way, you got to extract all the materials from the earth, and you want to do so sustainably and with as least impact to the environment as possible. And all of that costs money. And so how do we make all of that economical? And it's also through incorporating other technologies that may be more appropriate for a certain location, like geothermal type systems or wind power systems. You know, on wind power, I remember driving through Texas, out in the middle of nowhere, Texas, basically west of San Antonio before you hit El Paso, is just energy generation land. Like it is the desert. And it is pretty barren out there. But I remember driving for miles, for hours, and just seeing nonstop wind turbines on the horizon generating power. I remember driving by on I-10, seeing huge amounts of installations of energy distribution infrastructure. With nothing else around it, just massive installations prepared to distribution is when distribution of power is, you know, on the local level, but transmission is bringing energy across great distances, and the transmission infrastructure that was being constructed, actively built, shows that Texas is prepared to provide, or in preparation to provide, significant amounts of energy beyond what they already do for the United States. So looking to another technology that they've identified here is providing energy from fusion. And on this one, I just recently saw that China hit some incredible milestones in fusion on some $1 trillion installation, is what the news article said, you know, where they've achieved. They've achieved like three huge milestones, but they have not done them simultaneously. Like different run times have occurred, but they never accomplished all three of these simultaneously, which is going to be their next goal. But one is to, I think, achieve temperatures like 5 times hotter than the sun, which, okay, I'm curious what even that means. Like, how is that even remotely possible? The other one is like keep the fusion reaction running for, I think, like 1,000 seconds or something like that. I forgot what the other one was. I think it was maybe actually generating power from the fusion, that they were able to do that. Like generate more power from the fusion than the power required to create the fusion. Maybe that was the third one, because obviously it's going to require power to get it up and running, but you need more power to occur, or to be generated to make it worthwhile, obviously. But they were able to accomplish that. I'm not sure where the United States is on that. But we'll see. 21st century is a long time, and we're going to see if it's viable or not. So the next one here is to develop carbon sequestration methods, which essentially means to capture atmospheric carbon dioxide and then store that atmospheric carbon dioxide in a form that can be used to mitigate the effects of global warming and climate change. There's been a lot of criticism of this from even people who are in the industry, thinking that, you know, extracting carbon dioxide from the atmosphere is just not needed, or it's not economical to do so. While as other critics are saying that you shall need to do this, you will need to pull carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, because there's going to be too much, basically. So don't know too much about this. We're going to certainly dig into it. I do know, you know, big proponents like Bill Gates and the Amazon dude, Jeff Bezos, is out there pumping money into this type of technology. So we're going to see what we can get on that. So the next one is managing the nitrogen cycle. Now, I really should remember more from my environmental science class in high school, or my environmental engineering course from my undergraduate. But I don't know too much about this. So what the National Association of Engineers, National Academy. Yeah. So what the National Academy of Engineers website says is for managing the nitrogen cycle, engineers will help restore the balance to the nitrogen cycle through developing better fertilization technologies and by capturing and recycling waste. You know, I hear these horror stories where once prosperous fields have turned, you know, barren through a combination of poor planting practices and bad fertilizers. And, you know, our population is growing and we must feed them. And clearly we could try to do it better. You know, there's even on phosphorus, you know, Tampa area, east of Tampa, there's significant phosphorus deposits. And there's been some major environmental issues that, and actually a storage contaminant of high density phosphorus, a lake of it, was on the verge of breaking last year in 2021, and they had to end up discharge a ton of water directly into the bay, and we had some horrible red tide last year, and it is in part due to that practice. So anything we could do related to growing our food better with less chemicals, is clearly needed. You know, where I think there is unique technology that with this is like urban farms, you know, really built using hydroponics in really they're, you know, some of them are like, oh, well, here's a storage unit or the back of a semi-trailer type of thing, but you could build dedicated facilities for it. So I look forward to exploring some of that. And you know, the last one here regarding sustainability is providing access to clean water. And I think this one goes without saying, you know, even in the United States, there's been issues with clean water. You know, Flint, Michigan, with their lead pipes, when they swapped water sources from like a city supply to, I think, a Lake Michigan supply. You know, the change in the pH content between those two sources running it through the same pipes caused essentially corrosion, I believe, where the higher pH caused the water to leach contaminants into it from the piping, ending up with apparently lead in their water, which is crazy for that to happen in the United States. So we need to one, make sure that never happens again in the United States, but then also, you know, around the world, engineers and businesses, entrepreneurs, everybody has a role in providing clean water to the world. And so what the NAE says here is, you know, the world's water supplies are facing new threats. Affordable, advanced technologies could make a difference for millions of people around the world. And, you know, even, you know, we're going to talk about a lot of futuristic things on this podcast, but it's true that a large amount of the world does not have reliable access to clean water, and we should change that. And then even there are some locations that already have access to clean water, and I believe it's Azerbaijan that may be facing a water crisis in the very near future as their historical water source runs dry. It is not being maintained at its current level. It is being sucked dry, which will have profound impacts. Then even, you know, the effects of climate change will create a water crisis. So the last one here is the simple joy of living. So on this one, the National Academy of Engineers have outlined three topics. One is to enhance virtual reality. Two is to advance personalized learning. And three is to engineer the tools of scientific discovery. So this was first published back in like 2013, 2014 or so, I believe. And virtual reality is nowhere near what it was or is today back then. And, you know, all the talk at the end of 2021 was Facebook rebranding as Meta and their vision for the metaverse to work and play on, which there are legitimate critiques of that vision, as well as some potential positive things that could come from it. But, you know, virtual reality is here and it will become more prevalent. And it's a powerful tool that can be used for entertainment, you know, education. And then I was even starting to see it being potentially used for psychiatry. And once you start thinking about medical applications of it, it really opens it up to an infinite slate of things. And it's incredible to see where we'll be in 20 years from that tech. But it's also important that we avoid that turn towards a dystopian virtual reality future. You know, the Ready Player One future where people are holed up in the stacks of mobile homes rising to the sky and they just spend their days in virtual reality and that's all they do. They even work, they live, work, play in virtual reality, slaving away at the mines. And we need to avoid a dystopian future like that. The next one is to advance personalized learning. So I'm going to leave what the National Academy of Engineers says on this one, because I think they say it best. I don't know too much about it, but I do, you know, how we can maximize students' learning while still giving them a broad education, introducing them to just the massive amount that is this world. There are some students that will learn certain topics better and at a significantly heightened rate over other students, and we need to identify that and allow them to prosper and advance quickly. And so what the NAE says here is a growing appreciation of individual preferences and aptitudes has led towards more personalized learning in which instruction is tailored to a student's individual needs. Given the diversity of individual preferences and the complexities of each human brain, developing teaching methods that optimize learning will require engineering solutions of the future. And so, as I said, I do think there is an incredible opportunity to allow for individual students to learn at their own pace in each subject that I have no doubt will lead to incredible prodigies in every field of study who will lead the advancement of their field into the 21st century. And so finally, the last one, and I do feel like this podcast can kind of fit in a little bit with this topic, but it is engineering the tools of scientific discovery. So it's a pretty abstract one and probably even more abstract than engineering the brain, because that is a very specific focus. But when you think about it, there really are many unanswered questions that nature has presented to us. And then there are questions that have not even yet been asked, because we don't know yet how to ask the question. And finding those answers and partnering around the world will be necessary to answer those questions. And so very recently, the James Webb Space Telescope successfully deployed in space. It launched and it launched on a French rocket that was so precise. They had some fluff built into their fuel supplies. But the rocket performed so reliably that they did not need to use any of their extra fuel or very, very minor amounts of it. And it ended up extending the life of the James Webb Space Telescope by like 10 years or something, which is fantastic. But that telescope is the most powerful telescope ever. They're using like some super advanced sensors. I don't know too much about it. I'm going to learn. But that telescope is going to answer a lot of questions. Apparently, you can peer back into time at the shortly after the Big Bang. But while that telescope is going to answer questions, it will no doubt pose new questions because of what the telescope can see. And these questions we won't have answers to, and we probably will not have answers to those questions until the next generation of telescope is launched that will be built upon all the experiences that we learn and operate in the James Webb Telescope and incorporating, you know, technology. And this thing's been has been underdeveloped since the early 2000s is when development started. So imagine developing a new telescope with the type of tech we've developed, the type of lenses we've developed in 2030. It's going to be incredible. And, you know, how I think this podcast can relate to the engineering, the tools of scientific discovery, is I feel there's just not enough voices out there talking about engineering. And particularly not so many voices, but there's no face to engineering. The closest face, actually, you could see to it is really, it's like Elon Musk. Bill Gates was previously that, you know, Steve Jobs, and these are all CEOs, but Elon Musk kind of fits the bill, and he's a very polarizing figure. But there needs to be more people like that. And I hope this podcast can be an opportunity to put voices and faces of people who want to solve these challenges and put them towards the world, because I think we need more of that. We need more common goals. And I'm going to leave it at that. I hope this was an enjoyable listen. This has been the second episode of the Professional Engineer Podcast. So I just went through 14 topics here, and I want to drill down and think about these some more. These are all hot takes. I just took some brief notes to make sure I stayed on track with the keeping on all the 14 topics. So now I want to go do some more research, and eventually I'm going to start reaching out to people who know more about me in this field, and we're going to have some conversations. So thank you for listening to the Professional Engineer Podcast. Again, my name is Matt Dersheimer. Have a great one. See ya.